Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Swim podcasting, swim podcasting.
How's it going? Welcome to Swim Podcast episode number 10. I'm Daniel P. Carter, and the someone who isn't me on this one is Maynard James Keenan of Pussifer, Tool and A Perfect Circle. And when Pussifer were over here in London, they were playing at the Roundhouse in Camden. In support of their amazing album, The Money Shot. And they also recorded a Maid of Ale session for my show on BBC Radio 1, which you can still check out online. You should do that. It's great. Anyway, so over the course of the next hour or so, we spoke about comedy, music, art, the creative process, mysticism, wine, a little bit of politics, all sorts. It's a good one. I hope you enjoy this. Please tell everyone about the podcast. And do remember that it is very much a labour of love. So don't steal the audio and stick it up on your YouTube channel, because that's just not cool, is it? All right, this is Maynard James Keenan. Enjoy.
There was so much going on with the show, visually, and it sounded impeccable as well. And that place is notoriously bad sounding. It's
a round building. It's hard to really get the sound right. And depending on where you're standing, the things disappear, I would imagine.
Yeah.
You have to move around a little bit to really hear things properly.
Yeah, it sounded great, and it looked amazing.
Yeah, it was a tough room to kind of figure out how to fit the show in there. But apparently it worked out. People seemed to like it.
Yeah, I think that was the general vibe. How did you come about with the idea of the Lucadors and everything?
Well, normally when we're doing our shows, there's always a filmed element to it. And normally we'll kind of film bits so that we'll do a couple songs, then we'll be doing some kind of activity while of video bits is going on.
Yeah.
So kind of interim bits. And we were going to go film the Luchadors and kind of have a story attached to what they're doing. And they were like, why don't we just come out with you? Like, yeah. All right.
I like the fact that there was certain points, like when you did the Remedy, there's almost like it becomes this theatrical piece where they're arguing and the dancing and stuff as well. It was a good look.
Yeah, and it's, you know, they're very, you know, it's the Luchador thing's probably a little odd for the English to quite grasp, but there's, yeah, you know, this whole cultural thing down in the Southwest and the Mexican Luchadors. I think there's more of a story. A lot of the characters have their stories attached to them, so people kind of follow those characters like they would a soap opera. It's less, I guess I would have to talk to the guys to see what the separation is, but it's less... It's less bombastic than like the WWE stuff, you know, the breaking the chairs over the guys. And it's still athletic, you know. It's very, you know, if you see the acrobatics that they're going through. I mean, Eli last night had a concussion. He had to rush and take him to a medic. The little guy.
Oh, was that?
He actually had a bad fall.
Yeah, where he was, I saw the bit where he got like a pile driver from the top rope.
Yeah.
That was probably it, I would have thought. Yeah, amazing. And the cockfighting was amazing as well. And something that I think that every time you've done something with Pussifer that I've always thought is that, like, how much comedy there is in it. But then it's not just this, is it? It's everything you do, and it just seems like it gets missed at times. Do you feel that way?
I could see that with the other projects. Yeah. Some of the comedy being missed because it is subtle. It's there.
Yeah.
But with Pussifer, it's a little bit more up in your face. If you don't, you know, if you don't get the Andy Kaufman, Monty Python elements of this project, you're asleep or something. I don't know.
That's how it started, right? As was it on Mr. Show? Was that the first thing?
No,
there,
actually, Plucifer was actually, we were already doing stuff with Laura Milligan in the local comedy club.
Okay.
It was called, her show was called Tantrum, kind of a kind of variety show.
Yeah.
With a lot of comedians kind of working out their bits and working out their parts in this kind of very safe comedic setting with peers. And, you know, there's people coming who pay to see the show as well. But a lot of early upstarts at that in that venue with Brian Posehn, Patton Oswalt, Blanket Patch, Craig Anton, Bob Odenkirk, David Cross, Kathy Griffin,
wow.
Janine Garofalo. I think Will Ferrell actually came through with Simpatico at one point.
Yeah.
Tenacious D would usually close the show on odd nights. So it was quite a, you know, before you even heard any of these names, this is what we were doing in these clubs. And Pussifer was kind of the other band that was kind of closing the show when Tenacious D wasn't.
Uh-huh. I think it's interesting because, like, I listen to, I listen to Rogan or Duncan Trussell and Mark Maron as well, and it's that world is like, it's something I really appreciate and I've grown up with as well, but not in the same way. I mean, and it's interesting to see them talk about the sort of progression of how they got into each comic from the next guy, in the same way that most people get into music and, you know, mm-hmm. you discover a few bands to start with. And but I've heard you talk about stuff that comedy's played a real big part in your life when you're growing up, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, quite a bit. You know, I was watching Monty Python. I mean, of course, way back in the day, yeah. You know, you're up late night to watch Benny Hill just to see if you can catch a boob run by the TV.
Yeah.
I mean, comedy was, you know, watching Monty Python and Woody Allen stuff back then. It was, I could see the comedic elements of Woody Allen and.
Yeah.
Living in Ohio, I was definitely an island. I don't know how I got it, and my friends didn't, but because it's not like my parents grew up with it.
Is that ever something that you'd? I mean, this is your outlet for that, I guess, in that way, because it really seems like it's been like quite an important part of your sort of growing up.
Yeah, I could never do. You know, I think the sketch comedy stuff and doing little. You know, clever bits and putting on a wig and do those things. That's safe comedy. You know, we can kind of explore our own little areas and do little film bits and whatnot. It's fun. It's not nearly as daunting and challenging as the guys who choose the life of stand-up. That's just a brutal life choice, I think. Those guys are troopers for getting out there and enduring that kind of criticism and judgment, and you're just up there by yourself and make me laugh. Oh my, I already failed.
I look at solo performers, you know, singer songwriters and stuff, and I think that, you know, I can't get my head around that, but just to be there, that open and exposed, and just people like this,
mm-hmm.
expectant, horrendous.
Yeah,
but it's a fascinating thing, and it does seem to have, like, from an outside perspective, I think, played an important part in it, especially, like, you can see it in the live show with this. Was that, there was no desire to go into that then?
As far as just comedy straight, going into comedy? I mean, if that would have taken off, I mean, when I was actually doing it, I mean, I think everybody has this idea that, you know, Perfect Circle or Tool just kind of, it just started and it was huge.
Yeah.
It's not really the case. During that period of time, there was some traction with the comedy stuff, and there was a little bit of traction before that with the music, but it wasn't necessarily an established thing. It could have been.
So it could have gone either way, do you think?
It could have gone either way right at that moment. And, you know, looking at the people that I was working with as comedians at that point, it's not like I couldn't have done that and gone that way.
Yeah.
But the other one just kind of took off and took more of my time and was paying the bills, so I went that way.
I think there's definitely parallels between those two worlds, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the amount of time, you know, some of the stuff that I had in mind for Pussifer early on, we just couldn't couldn't afford to do it back then. You'd have to have a big deal, and if it didn't go, they own all your material and, you know, huge budgets and kind of stuff we get away with now. You know, it's
it's a big show.
Edited on your laptop, and you know, there's no big, huge catering budget, and you can do animation, you can do film without having to have a $1 million budget and some producer and a studio involved. So back then, though, 95, 94, you couldn't do that. Back then, it was, you would have to have some kind of underwriters or some kind of sponsors to get that going.
And that would have just...
And the technology wasn't there yet either, so...
Yeah. I mean, that is a beautiful thing these days, I guess. As horrendous as the internet is as a place or an entity.
Yeah, well, it's a good... You know, the internet, love it or hate it, it's a really interesting... look into human nature and kind of where you are as a culture. Just traveling already, just two shows in the UK, and it's apparent to me that your education system here is far superior to the one in the US, just because of the nature and structure of the comments on Twitter feed, on Facebook. It's clear that you invented the language.
Yeah, perhaps. Maybe it's just that you have the more discerning people commenting.
Yeah, I mean, we all have that side of our culture. But I think it's an interesting observation to see that the eloquent, thoughtful enthusiasm expressed through social media has been very inspiring for me for this visit. It's been
It makes me
want to come back. So
yeah, do you think there'll be much more of it than touring here?
I don't know. I mean, when we get into the, you know, when we get into Netherlands and Germany, I have no idea how that'll go. but the UK, absolutely, it makes me want to come back. I want to do, you know, Glasgow. I want to go, you know, up into Dublin. I want to get all over the islands and just dive in, because I think this is a good market, because it's a cornball unit. I mean, the music's there. We're very focused on making sure that we deliver through our songs, our music, and the vocals. But the comedy element, it's night and day. The appreciation for comedy in the U.S. Is so sophomoric compared to the appreciation for comedy in the U.K. So I feel like some of our cornball stuff, you guys get it.
Yeah.
And that's more appreciated here.
But when you play over in the States, it's the same show, though, essentially, right? You're not.
But a lot of stuff goes right over people's heads. They miss it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is weird. But I would have thought that that the people that are coming to see the band are going to be the ones that are the more...
You would think that.
Yeah, I would.
But easily, you know, I've had so many comments from people saying, you know, we have a song called, you know, The Life of Brian, apparently you haven't seen, and it's basically, if you've seen Monty Python's The Life of Brian as many times as I have, I guess maybe it's just because I'm obsessed, but even if you've seen the film, there is kind of a thrust to the movie. You're all individuals, that whole scene, and I mean, that's the whole movie, really. It's all the way through the movie. And people in the U.S., they don't understand the connection, what the song has to do with that movie.
Wow.
It's like, oh my God, I don't have the time in a day to help you with that.
Yeah, how can you not tie that together?
Yeah, so it's really, that's when you just kind of go, all right.
Yeah. I mean, wow.
You're going to drive me to drink.
Yeah, right? It's funny because, like, you know, it's so obvious in certain places, like... In The Arsonist, like the Beavis reference and stuff. I loved that last night as well, with the cornholio.
Mm-hmm.
I have a thing for that. I was just sketching while you were doing it and stuff. But you went to art school, right, in Michigan?
Yeah.
And do you think, because it seems like with Pussifer, it seems like you're, like, not that any of the other projects have these boundaries, but it just seems like this one is it can just go anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of what the project was meant to be initially, was just an outlet for the things you weren't allowed to do anywhere else, regardless, you know, never mind the bands, just like in general for friends of mine, musicians that, you know, want to just, you know, we want to be a hardcore band this week. Okay, let's just go be a hardcore band. You know, do AC/DC top to bottom, just do a song, you know, do a whole set of that.
Yeah.
And have people go, oh yeah, it's Pussifer, deal with it.
Yeah, it's yeah, there's very few other bands that I can think of that can do that, and yet, you know, deliver these records that are really artful and beautiful records.
Yeah, I think that's, and that's the only way we can get away with it. Honestly, I think we have to deliver the music properly, or at least entertain you with the music, even with the old, you know, some of the earlier country stuff that we did. It was, you know, jokey. It still has to be, you know, fun to listen to. If it's not fun to listen to, you're not going to stick around for very long.
Yeah. You know, when you were studying art and stuff, where were you headed with that? Just out of interest, were you looking at, because what did you study? Was it fine art, right?
Yeah, it was printmaking.
Okay.
A little bit of sculpture, kind of. Of course, all your drawing and perspective classes, I think those are invaluable for me.
Yeah.
Just, you know, in general, as a, just an expressive artist, just understanding those techniques, even though I don't necessarily use them, you know, directly with this, but, you know, standing back and looking at our stage, you know, you're definitely, there's,
oh yeah,
there's broad sweeps of those.
Yeah, definitely, those compositionally and
yeah, the composition is everything. Yeah, but I didn't really. Yeah, the art school was, it was an interesting experience, and it taught me those things. But printmaking was what I kind of got into, because I just kind of enjoyed the process.
Yeah, what type of print was it?
Italio, so I was doing a lot of copper etching.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so, you know, making my own inks and, you know, doing all the etching process.
Do you still draw?
Not really.
No.
No.
Do you not have the desire? Are you satisfied? Because I find that. Because I paint a bit, and, you know, I play music a little bit as well, and I find that it's almost as if I have only, this is a failing obviously, but only have so much that I can focus on.
Mm-hmm.
and it's not like I don't mean that in a I can't multitask kind of way. Well, I can't, but I mean in the sense that, like, I become so obsessed with, if I'm working on music, then the painting really falls behind.
Mm-hmm.
And vice versa.
Yeah, especially, you know, combining, you know, writing for three bands and having, you know, being a winemaker. And the winemaking is very hands-on, so that process, although it's very utilitarian and it's very physical, there's still an artistic side to it, and you have to have some intuition and, you know, natural instincts to really make that work. And they're not going to work if you're not paying attention.
Yeah,
so definitely. Even if you have the instincts and if you have the natural talents for it or the inclinations for it, it's not going to work if you're not present for it. So, yeah, so I guess you're right. I think a lot of those things end up kind of falling away, the drawing, the painting, the printmaking. You don't have the bandwidth to do them if you're really going to focus on the other things.
And has the winemaking, has that got to the point where have there been times where music's fallen away because you're so focused on that? As you said, it's such a physical
thing. No, because that's always, you know, the music's always kind of, you know, rattling around in my head.
Yeah.
Just kind of thinking about processes or approaches to things. It's always there. You know, because there's a lot of downtime during the winemaking process.
Yeah, I guess because it's a seasonal thing, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And certain things happen at certain times.
Yeah, even during the season, when we're processing, I have that, you know, those 3 hours window of just being able to sit and listen or write, or, you know, because that's you know, writing is that process. You know, I'm not sitting there 24 hours a day writing stuff down.
Yeah.
I'm having to, like, you know, take a minute, think about it, let it marinate, come back.
Hmm. And when you're writing, do you sit and specifically work out what you're going to be writing for, or is it you find a home for things once it's done?
Oh no, I'm always writing to rhythms or you know, pieces of melodies.
Yeah,
there's always something that's been recorded, a jam of some sort, or yeah, depending on the project, some things have to be finished arrangements, others have to be, you know, initial thoughts with simple structures. It's, you know, it's all very fluid.
Yeah. As a time management thing, it's mind-blowing for me to see. Especially when, you know, I watch the film and to see the process of that goes into the winemaking and the growing and the, you know, the grafting of vines. And how did that come about?
You know, that sounds not, I'm not, this is not a dismissive statement, but it, I think the winemaking kind of chose me.
Yeah.
I don't know, that sounds like I'm making it up, but
no, I totally understand.
Yeah, I think I just kind of fell into it. I have a natural instinct for it. And it came very easily, and I saw a lot of potential with it, especially for our region. So I just kind of, I kind of dove in. I felt like if I have the natural instincts to pull this off, I probably should really pursue it because our area needs it. We got a lot of potential there.
Yeah. So it was a calling of sorts.
I guess, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So I know that there was a huge amount of trial and error with finding the right, the right things for the right area for the soil.
It's still going on.
Yeah?
Yeah, that's going to be that's another 10-year, 20-year process of us really trying to figure it out as a state.
Wow, that's such a, having that long-term outlook on
yeah,
it.
Yeah, when we actually figure it out and we've actually seen the results and have proven them for the third time to be right, I won't even be around. It'll be just, it's more of a legacy. It's just,
yeah.
You're kind of literally planting roots for the future.
And is that an important aspect of why you do it, or is that just
I think that's something that you know, over here you guys have endured world wars, you know, trudging across your soils, you know, not even, you know, even pre World War I and II, just like the, you know, the areas combating combative forces just try to secure their areas. And even with all that going on, the areas that seemed to kind of just weather all that storm were the ones that had some pretty solid wine coming out of them. There's like a, they're like a hub, they're an anchor for, you know, the guy who raises goats, the guy who works on machinery. There's all these little things that, you know, the, you know, baking bread, it all ends up being these little things that can kind of hang their hat on this secure long-term endeavor, which is the winemaking and the vineyards. There's so much time and commitment attached to those, and it seems that those particular areas don't care king, queen, dictator, general, president. They don't really care who's in charge, or in theory, for them, who's in charge is the wind and the sun and the rain. So that's, they're kind of marching to that beat, and it transcends the politics.
There's something quite mystical about it as well, without wanting to sound too, but I think the idea of the history of it and it, when you go back into the mythology of it as well, it's really rich and vibrant and it resonates. Is that something that also?
Yeah, I definitely, you know, have to nod your hat to that a little bit, because there's definitely there's probably a reason a lot of that's sewn into the practices and the stories, just because there is some kind of long-term commitment, resonance to it. And of course, everything has its foundation, everything has its origin. So there's probably some, you know, there's probably something to it. If they're in those religions, if there's all those stories, kind of have the winemaking and the vine, metaphorically or literally.
Yeah.
There's something to it.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's interesting as well, like a lot of your, aside from the vineyard being called Merkin, which...
Can't help it.
Yeah. But Caduceus as well sort of alludes to that, I think. And also a lot of the names of some of the wines, like Anubis and Nagual and Kitsune and Chupacabra. Not that one's quite so much, because that one's a little more...
the American wines tend to a little bit more playful.
Yeah. But there, I mean, there's a lot of sort of references to these sort of anamorphic beings.
Yeah.
Is that like a? It's obviously it's not coincidence, I guess.
No, not at all. Yeah, we are trying to connect, our feet to the ground and our hands to the heavens.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And that's essentially what the vines are themselves, aren't they?
Yeah.
I heard you say in another interview, and I'm probably quoting it wrong, but where you said, I think this kind of ties in, for me anyway, it's kind of bouncing around a bit, where you said that that if you don't believe in magic, then your art's probably going to suck.
Yeah, you have to have, I think, you kind of have to buy into something bigger than you.
Yeah.
To really kind of,
I would find it hard to comprehend that people make music and not look at it that way, but they clearly are. There's people making music because they want to bang chicks and...
Yeah, but those guys don't last long.
True.
Generally speaking.
God willing.
That's very short-lived. If that's your focus.
Because I think all art and music comes from that place. However you want to dress it up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it is very much opening yourself up to things. And whether you want to call that a muse and being inspired, or whether you want to really get kooky with it and call it channeling.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the point of, going back to Life of Brian. I think people they confuse the finger pointing at the bigger idea. They get focused on the finger rather than the bigger idea.
Yeah.
So I think some people, when they have those moments and they get caught up in whatever rock star lifestyle that is, that they had a moment that something connected and they saw something bigger and they kind of pursued that and they got popular, then you kind of get derailed. You're so focused on the reward from having had that moment.
Yeah.
You forgot how to get back in that headspace and honor that moment with a few more.
And is that your driving motive then?
Yeah, just to continue to put together those pieces that are like metaphorical breadcrumbs.
Yeah.
Not that they're going to lead anywhere, but it's just, I think that's kind of that is the life pursuit, isn't it? There is no answer. You just kind of continue asking better questions and having fun on the way.
Yeah. Yeah, most definitely. I think that's very clearly part of everything that you've done musically. There's I could probably count on my hand the amount, I like a lot of different bands, so this isn't me talking shit about bands in general, obviously, but there are certain bands that feel like they're more than just Skinny Room, write some songs, guys. Mm-hmm.
I'm not begging on modern, the current state of music. But I mean, why wouldn't you at this stage in the game when nobody actually pays for music and there's nothing to nurture you, a space to nurture a garage band style setting where you can actually nurture and find your way without anybody interrupting you, without having to have a budget to, pay for some gorgeous rehearsal space that's all licensed and insured and all those things. I mean, back in the day, we were living, we find the old warehouse downtown and pay the caretaker $10 a month to just let us not burn the place down, but get stuff done. You don't have that anymore. And so why wouldn't you just pick one song that was popular that you guys can actually pull off and do an entire album that sounds like that one popular song you like? And that's your whole identity, is not even like identifying with a band, but like identifying with a single song from that band and then making an entire album that sounds like that song to get popular.
I don't
that's not what I'm gonna do, but I can see why, young bands coming up, that's their process. There's no songwriting. They're just gonna take an old song and regurgitate it in different ways 12 times.
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of that. But as you said, that stuff generally does fall by the wayside pretty quick.
Yeah.
Hopefully. But, yeah. It's, so if that's the mindset, then How have you gone about finding the people you work with each time? Because I know that with Tool it was one thing, and that, and I guess that would have been the basis of establishing you as an artist, so that other artists would then kind of look over and go, is it that people gravitated towards you, or how have you gone around choosing like the lineups, especially for Pussifer? Because it's,
well, Pussifer is definitely a combination of those things, because a lot of the people that I'm working with still behind the scenes in Pussifer were the people that I was working with comedy,
yeah,
back in the day, not necessarily as a result of the music career.
Yeah.
Just, you know, the animators and some of the writers, and Laura Milligan, of course, on the cover of the Conditions,
yeah,
album. You know, I've been working with her for, you know, 22 years. I guess some of that, because of the popularity, yeah, you can definitely leverage some of those things to kind of lay out a little bit of a beacon, you know,
yeah,
throw up your bat signal to kind of get people to come around.
Yeah, that's what I imagined it to be like somewhat.
But yeah, but even so, like, not, you know, it's definitely a weeding out process, because, you know, especially living in an area like, I know when I was living in LA, it draws a lot of flies too. So you really have to weed out,
yeah,
who you're actually going to work with, people you can trust that are going to make the right artistic decisions with integrity. And it's a long, hard process, and you don't always make that right choice. But with the projects that I've been involved with, I've been very, very blessed with,
yeah,
with being able to see most of the douchebags coming,
yeah,
and settling in on quite a few awesome, awesome, talented people. I mean, there's no way I could do everything I'm doing if I didn't surround myself with the talented people that I surround myself with. You know, I would love to take credit for all this stuff. I cannot take credit for half of it. There's just a lot of really good people around me.
Yeah, that's a talent, to be able to pull those people in and then to get the best out of them.
Yeah.
Something with this is, like, the initially as well, I mean, obviously having, you know, saying coming through comedy and having bits and recording film stuff, so that there would be different looks, but it's something that you've always done. Do you find that what's the motive for some of that? Is that, like, to keep yourself amused? Is it to blow people's minds on what they presume you're going to be about, like the different characters almost and the different looks? Or does it actually serve a purpose for when you're creating?
I think it's just upbringing.
Yeah.
You know, early on, I don't even remember, I don't know if it was over here, but like in the U.S. you had a lot of like Laugh-In, you had the Sonny and Cher show, you had,
yeah,
Hee Haw.
I don't know.
Hee Haw was like a lot of like, you know, country sketches.
Okay.
And but it was, then you had Roy Clark playing guitar for,
yeah,
a bit, where he's just shredding on the guitar, or a banjo player would come on, or, you know, just really amazing music, along with these really funny, you know, recurring characters and recurring,
yeah,
themes. You know, same thing with Sonny and Cher. They would have the variety. They were the odd guest on, that they would do a song, and or they would do little bits, Laugh-In, same thing. It was just all over the map.
Yeah, we had the equivalent here, I guess.
You know, to a lesser, not as much music, of course, but Vic and Bob, you know.
Yeah.
You know, stuff like that, where, like, it's there's a lot of character-driven things. More recently, you know, Little Britain and...
Yeah.
But those don't really have the music, so it's, you know, Monty Python had a couple songs,
yeah,
but it was definitely more of the performance sketch-driven things. But
your
comedy, when I grew up, it was more of a balance. Like, Hee Haw had music and the comedy all intertwined. So it's not anything I'm not reinventing the wheel on this. I'm just trying to bring it a little bit, you know, bring it back in some way. I think there's a nice balance with that. And, you know, I've got two bands that are just bands.
Yeah.
If I'm going to do a third, it better be something different.
Yeah, but even in those bands, I mean, that you know, you would have very specific looks, and some of them, like, you know, I remember seeing those shows where you'd come out in full, like, weird kabuki face makeup with a huge bra on. You know,
thank you.
That is a beautiful thing. It's a wonderful image. But I mean, you know, that was blowing people's minds. But I mean, was that the intention to go, we're not this band that you think we are, or is it a case of putting on a mask almost allows you to do certain things that you wouldn't have done creatively otherwise?
I think both. Yeah, it really does. It really does open up performance possibilities when you're writing songs that are very close to the heart, but then you can kind of put the mask on and kind of dance around like the clown and go, but it's all going to be okay.
Okay.
It's all going to work out.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Okay. Because I spoke to Jazz Coleman recently for one of these.
Speaking of nutcakes.
Wow. Lovely guy.
Yeah.
He likes to get into it. He was blowing my mind, man.
Yeah.
You know, I have a lot of those interests. And I said he was on the podcast, and the thing was, I said in the intro, I felt like I don't want to sound like a crazy person filter just turned off. Like it was this palpable thing where it was, I could feel it. And it was like, okay, we can talk about anything.
Anything.
But he had some really interesting stories about magic, especially. But he was also telling me about, you know, the persona that he literally becomes. It's not he it's almost like a ritualistic invocation of becoming this guy that he is when he's on stage.
You have to get out of the way and let the energy just kind of come through. And the best way to do that is to get the hell out of the way.
And do you think putting things
absolutely.
On
absolutely that's the doorway, that's you getting out of the way,
tuning in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
When did you discover that was going to be the? Because it's quite an intuitive thing, isn't it? Obviously, and as soon as you start playing with archetypes, it is a ritualistic thing. I very much see it that way. A lot of people think it sounds like bollocks when you start talking about that stuff, and they think you're nuts. But whatever.
I'm not sure where I first discovered it, but you know, most of my early upbringing was in high school, of course, were sports. You know, sport activities that were all you. I mean, there's nothing you couldn't hide behind anything. You couldn't ride the pine and just kind of be a part of the team, but without actually doing anything. As a wrestler,
yeah,
that's you. I mean, that's you're competing against yourself, your own will. And another person who's trying to enforce their will on you. So, and there's no hiding. It's that's the two of you out there doing that.
Yeah.
Did you prepare or did you not? How did you do against yourself? How did you do against him? Same thing with cross country. You can't coast. It's either you're either finishing the race or you're not. You can't rely on somebody else to carry you, or looking for a Michael Jordan on your team to kind of. You can't. You can't do that.
Yeah.
But I think in contrast from the arts, it's still kind of you having to deliver. But I think there's having that channeling whatever that larger idea, that magic kind of coming through, it's a different thing, much different than having to be focused and present like you would have to be for as a wrestler or a cross-country runner.
Yeah. But then performance is quite in the moment at the same time, so it's almost like it's like flipping between the two, right?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. There's an in and out of body.
Yeah.
That can be kind of exhausting. I don't know. Yeah, it's hard. I'm in the middle of it, so I don't know.
I guess so.
It's kind of hard to describe it.
Yeah.
And even if I did, unless you've experienced it, that's not going to mean anything.
Yeah. But then, yeah. Oh, no, I hear what you're saying. But I think that the opportunity to lay down those sort of signposts almost for other people.
Yeah.
Because, you know, as you said earlier, there's a lot lacking in not music in general, but, you know, just in a lot of art, well, living, essentially. There's a lot missing in people living these days. But I think that maybe to lay down those signposts would make things clearer for people. But then I think that's what the music is essentially anyway, right?
Yeah, an unconscious map.
Yeah.
That hopefully you can kind of lay down some basic ideas of how to figure it out for yourself, but here's a basic map.
Do you feel like, well, you don't strike me as this type of person that would feel obliged in any way to the people? No, that sounds wrong. Are you aware of the expectation when people come and see you perform? Because I feel that, because as you know, like in the same way as you saying that when you're finding people that you want to collaborate with,
mm-hmm.
and make art, it's like throwing up the bat signal, for want of a better description. But then I think that there are certain artists that are doing that constantly, so the point that their fan bases and the people that are interested in what they're doing are almost expectant. So I don't know what I'm saying. I got lost. But yeah, I don't know. It just feels like there's a lot of expectant weight on the stuff that you do and artists as well that I would sort of.
Yeah, I mean that's a hard line to tread of like you're doing a thing and you've established something and people want to come back for more of that.
Yeah.
Again, I think it's the metaphor conversation of. I had a friend of mine describe, she was going to a very loud kind of rock band was performing. And she didn't really go to a lot of those shows. She's really into the Kundalini yoga, and she's up, you know, doing Breath of Fire every morning at 5 a.m. or 4 a.m.
Okay.
So she went to this very loud show, and just some of the aggressive nature and, you know, expectant and fervent nature of the fans, it all made sense to her because she's watching these people react to this band. And she said, I get it. They come here because whatever noise or whatever story is coming off that stage is moving something in them that they can't move themselves.
Yeah.
The problem with that is that the band wasn't teaching them how to fish.
Yeah, here's a fish. Eat it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're handing him the fish, and so I could see that. So when people are like angry at me for not giving them the things that they want, I feel like I've failed as an artist because I haven't taught them how to fish in a way. You're looking for something from me. Like if you're waiting for somebody like me who's just as confused as you are,
yeah,
we're all fucked. You know?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
If we accidentally gave you a thing one day to help you with something, you're waiting for the next thing. Oh my God.
Yeah.
We're all doomed.
Yeah.
Cuz I don't have it. I don't have the answer.
Yeah.
But I, you know, so to, but to her point, like, you know, I could see that she got that some people just weren't there's just some people that are never going to end up figuring out a way to move that thing in themselves. Although if I had a message for anybody, it would be look at yourself to see what it is you think you need from somebody and realize that's something you have to develop in yourself.
Yeah.
If there's anything I can share, that would be it. Figure out what you see as your, figure out what it is you're needy about and fix it in yourself.
Get your shit in order and deal with
it. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I saw that you have the book coming out in November.
Mm-hmm.
Why now, and what was the reasoning behind that? Because, you know, to be honest with you, I was overjoyed that we're getting to do this now, because it just seemed like it wasn't something that you did an awful lot of, and I think putting a book out there is, and it's fuck to put out an awesome to put out an autobiography is really. That seems like the antithesis of what, again, people
well, the way
assume.
It's written, it's not necessarily an autobiography. It's not a kiss and tell novel. It's written. That's why I used a friend of mine, Sarah Jensen. She's the older sister of my high school friend, and she's a writer, and she's very diligent in her research.
Yeah.
And the reason I worked with her on it is because we were going to write it like a story. So you're not it's one version of my life story. It's not necessarily all the details of everything that's ever happened. It's one particular trail of breadcrumbs that we follow as a storyline, and you're walking along with the person in the story like you're reading a fantasy novel.
Okay.
So it's not necessarily, and then I did this, and then I did that.
Hmm.
So it's kind of a story of a journey.
So this is November. It's due.
Yeah, it's
done.
Yeah, it's done. Yeah. It's all done. It's going through all the processes that things go through,
uh-huh.
And it's scheduled for November release.
Were you approached about this, or was it something you
wanted
to do?
Oh no, this is something. It was approaching my 50th birthday, and I thought might be good to lay down the foundation of a particular semi autobiography.
Yeah.
Story. To just do something to commemorate a 50th year. So we kind of started writing it right around my 49th year, just to see where we would go with it. It took a little longer than I thought it would take, but again, Sarah was really good at doing more of my prehistory due diligence, like back to my great great grand. Parents.
Okay.
That far to kind of bring the story that far back and forward.
I read somewhere that your great grandparents were winemakers as well. Is that right?
My great grandfather was he made wine in northern Italy, in northwestern Italy.
Okay.
Yeah, Piemonte area, but not in the sweet spot, unfortunately. Kind of more up to the French Alps area.
Was that something that you were aware of when you were growing up, or
not
is it just
all.
Something that you've come?
I found out about him way later. I was actually planting vines before I found out that.
Wow.
That he was actually a winemaker, and oddly enough, Italian vines do really well where I'm living now. So it just all kind of came around. That's part of that kind of winemaking finding me.
Yeah.
Part of the story.
Yeah, that's pretty magical. Wow, that's crazy. I also read that, sorry, this is all a bit, I read this and I read that, I apologize.
Well, at least you can read.
Well, exactly, I try. I don't get on so well, but that you had a dream about a place of where you wanted to move to when you wanted to get out of LA, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And then when you described that, was it to Tim Alexander?
Well, Tim Alexander doesn't remember that conversation.
Okay.
He doesn't remember me actually describing the place.
Hmm.
He remembers it as he just wanted to take me to the place.
Okay.
And then when I got there is when I recognized it as that place. So I think I got my wires crossed on me actually describing it to him. I think he just took me to that place, not knowing that that was the place I was looking for.
Wow. Which is even crazier.
Yeah.
Does that happen a lot?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? How so?
Just in various things.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of it is just you being open to those things, doing your work.
Yeah.
You have to be involved. You have to be conscious and present and moving.
Yeah.
You can't just let things happen. You've got to, make your own fate. Mm. But if you're open to it, the universe will nod in your direction on occasion. Doesn't mean anything. Doesn't mean that there's any kind of big plan, or doesn't mean if there's any, pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. It's just being in tune and being inspired by those moments where the universe nods, and you just continue on your way.
Yeah. But it gives you the awareness that exists.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an empowering thing, because then it will become more and more frequent as you become more attuned to it and start to give a lot more credence to these things.
Yeah, you can give credence to it, but as far as like assigning meaning and purpose to it, that's when you start religions, and that's where it all goes sideways.
Yeah, true. Yeah, there's a big difference between the two things, I think. Yeah. I saw that there was a similar thing where you'd said about where you had a dream about Bill Hicks and contacted his management.
Yeah, then I'd let him call him, and he's like, oh, yeah, he's not in a good way.
Yeah.
So those kind of things, they happen. Again, he had to be open to those things actually happening.
Yeah, I think so. And I sometimes pay too much attention to them, but try and... Maybe I should just accept them at face value a bit too much.
Well,
but
if those things come into your life and you, in those kind of moments, and you kind of go off on a tangent and you write an entire book or do a song or whatever you're going to create from it, and you go away to the edge, you get all Salvador Dali on it, that's fine.
Hmm.
Everybody has their role. You have to have the people that go too far.
Yeah, so you know when to stop.
Let them go too far. Or some people are just risk takers and just go for it all the way.
Yeah.
Is there any?
Obviously, this alludes to, I guess we're kind of skirting around it somewhat. Have you ever is this all just personal work, I guess, or have you ever sort of followed any sort of set method or school along those lines? Or have you just read a bunch and taken what you like?
I just take the bits I like and whichever kind of resonates with me. I don't think there's any particular... Every religion has its... There's things that make sense.
Yeah.
That's why they end up resonating with people.
Yeah.
It's all the other bullshit they end up kind of inserting into it that kind of ends up derailing people in a way to control land masses, in pursuit of love and power.
Yeah.
It's never going to go away.
Yeah. I find it interesting as well that, going back to, obviously your history in the military is something that always gets spoken about, but it seems like... Well, I know that you that you studied wrestling, and I know that the running was a big part of your growing up as well. So then they're both very disciplined and regimented things. But as I understand it, you joined the army for a college fund to go and study art, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which it seems almost like...
Well, look, in hindsight, I can't understand why I made that choice, but I'm glad I did.
Yeah.
Just for the sake of balance, I'd love to claim that I had it all mapped out and I knew what I was going to do, but that's not ever the case.
No.
Things just, things happen or they don't.
Yeah. Yeah. No, yeah. 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 That's a weird one, though. To go into that world, because that was something I thought I was going to do as well, not the army, but I have an elder brother who was in the Fleet Air Arm, which was the planes and helicopter side of the Royal Navy, and he's I guess nearly 10 years older than me, So yeah, when I was growing up, that was the thing as well, and I had it all worked out that that's what I was going to do. You know, I looked.
Well, I mean, that's something we all struggle with. We have this idea that we're going to make this plan. There's going to be this structure, and it's just things are just going to be that way forever because you can. There's comfort in having an idea what's coming, but it's just the world's just not like that.
Yeah,
and many, you know, and then all of a sudden there's a meteor. And everything changes, or, you know, I mean, just imagine, and I don't know if you had it over here, but I think you kind of have a version of it here, but in LA for years, if you're going to work on sets as a, you know, in production at all, art dog, whatever you're going to do, you had to have this thing called a Thomas guide. And basically what it was is a map of the city.
Okay.
Broken up into grids. So the whole book was a page was, you know, C14 or whatever. So you could find when somebody goes, we need you to go pick up these lamps and you need to go to this particular place.
Yeah.
So this book, you would have to buy this thing, and they weren't cheap. Hmm. And there's different versions of them. So for San Fernando Valley, for, you know, the LA County area, you would have these entire books as a driver or a guy running around grabbing all these things. As a runner, you would have to have this thing to find your way around to make sure that you got your you still had a job tomorrow.
Yeah,
you can find the route. You know, you have to figure out your best routes to get to these places and get them back. Now imagine that's your company. That's your foundation. You put together this Thomas guide. You spent lots of money putting it all together. That's kind of the foundation of what your company is. And then along comes smartphone and maps and GPS. Yeah. That company's gone.
Yeah.
So people who hung their hat on this family business that's going to be around, that's been around for generations, is now gone. Within 5 years, the record industry in general just.
Yeah. But then I think a lot of that is to do with the short-sightedness of the people involved. I don't mean the artists. The labels themselves, obviously,
I guess my point is just like the things, just using some of the music industry or that you know, that mapping, just something comes along that changes everything. So any plans you have about anything, you can't really get married to any of those plans.
Yeah.
It just doesn't, you know, even planting vines. If the environment in some way shift as it has, as history has shown us, ice ages and whatnot, extreme things happen. So whatever you had in mind, that was a clever plan you had.
Yeah.
And then it's all turned on its head. So if you just kind of embrace that, I think that's the hardest part for most people to get, is that whatever changes are coming. For the environment or whatever.
Yeah.
The next phase might not include us, and that's the hardest part for us to wrap our head around is that we mean we're not a part of the next phase? Maybe not.
I mean, you look at the Kurzweil's vision of what the future's going to be, and he's got this really rosy idea that everybody's going to be interfaced with these supercomputers, and there's been nanobots all in it, but no, it's not that. So you're going to create something which is going to go
one simple
guys have really fucked this up, you're done.
One simple burst from the sun, and EMP erases all of those things, and we don't have the faintest idea how to tie our shoes. We're screwed. There's so much technology we rely on, that, you know, you can't download the app to show you how to start a fire with Flint, you know.
Is that one of the reasons that that's obviously something that's really important to you, though, then going out to Arizona and working the land and actually being in contact with it and understanding it and having this life. Because it's so true. People have, and I say people like I'm not one, but I, you know, everybody is so embedded now in this, you know, like hive-like thing of living in a city and just expecting to go and have food delivered to here and no thought of what's going into their bodies, and it's crazy.
Well, you know, I like the idea of settling into the idea that in my lifetime that won't change, and I'll just kind of embrace it and roll with it. But
I think it will.
It'd be kind of interesting to live through a period where that's not the case, and get to, while I'm starving in a corner, go, I told you so.
Yeah.
You know?
Build a compound, start stocking up tins of beans.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a crazy one, man. Like, I was listening to, Drive. I've got, I signed up to Audible and was just listening to Bill Bryson's A Short History of Nearly Everything. And he's talking about the whole thing about meteors. Mind-blowing.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's so many. I mean, if you start looking at, you know, some of that science, the amount of times in the last 20 years that we almost had a solar flare that was that EMP, like that we barely narrowly escaped that thing. And I'm not necessarily a doomsday guy, but I just think it's funny how those things were happening all the time, but everything we've hung our hat on as far as part of our culture and even just our energy and utility systems being hinged on some very simple.
Yeah,
it's kind of daunting as to what would happen in that. But again, it'll be a temporary in the scope of time. It'll be a temporary blip.
You think?
Yeah, whatever would happen. Of course, it'll be. Like an eternity for us living through it, but it'll sort itself out very quickly.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Graham Hancock, and also I like to subscribe to the whole ancient aliens thing. But you start looking back at those things, and it's like, yep, slate's been wiped clean more than once before.
Yeah,
which most people think sounds like just proper tinfoil hat crazy talk, but.
No.
There's much too much evidence for it, I think.
Yeah, and the idea that we've been here a lot longer than we think we've been here is, I think that's a much easier pill to swallow than we just got here 10,000 years ago or whatever.
And look at what we've achieved. We're doing great. Yeah.
Yeah, I disagree.
Yeah, all right, cool. Well, I think that's a good point to finish. On a cheery note.
Good, we... We avoided any Trump conversations. Good.
Yeah, I didn't want to
darken the.
Fuck, man! What a world! I think now that whole thing. Now you've started me off.
Sorry.
I think it's got to be a joke. It has to be. I'm just gonna see how far we can go with this.
Okay,
now.
Let's take it to a. I'm gonna put my tinfoil hat on.
Okay.
And I'm gonna talk metaphysically. About it all. I'm going to step way back. You can call me crazy. I'm just giving you the tinfoil hat.
I'm all about it. Go.
Version of this. We have moved from that patriarchal mindset into a matriarchal mindset. And I think you can talk to some of the woo-woos and they'll tell you there's like a cycle. I think it's 10,000 year cycle or something like that. And which is very, the patriarchal warring, protective, masculine mindset. Now we've shifted now where it's not that survival mode as much anymore as it has been over the last thousands of years, and it's moved into a more matriarchal mindset. This is according to the woo-woos. This is, this might, again, tinfoil hat talk. So this could be just everything that's going on in the last, 10 years, 15 years. Could be that last, not last dying gasp, but definitely like a struggle for the old dogs in charge of, above and beyond the scope of, the governments and whatnot. It's a metaphor for that last gasp of that old mindset.
Going shit or bust.
Yeah, with the Trump thing, I just feel like that's kind of like that last, that old way of thinking is going to get loud. It's not going to go quietly into the night. It's gonna shriek a little bit, and that's what you're seeing. especially with all the religious, you know, ISIS and everything else. Yeah. Just that a lot of that's the same kind of thing. It's just really, it's more present. And I'm not a big fan of any of the candidates, really. But I feel like from a metaphysical stepping way out of it perspective, I think the 8 years of having the first African-American president is a step in the right direction spiritually. Never mind whether you think about the candidate or whatever was going on, or whatever was accomplished or not accomplished or undermined or whatever. That's not really the big point. I'm not a huge fan of Hillary Clinton either, but I feel like that's probably going to happen.
As the next logical step.
Having a female president. It's, if nothing else, just a step in the right direction, even though she might be an asshole. I don't know.
Yeah.
It might be what's going to happen.
Yeah, because from an outside perspective, it's interesting that you put it like that. I'd never really thought of it in that sense, as if this was like the last point before the wheel turns. But it just seems so fucking ridiculous. Like, it's not just...
It's a comics cornucopia.
Yes, of course, to the point where it has to be scripted, surely, because it's like, surely no one is that much of a fucking idiot.
Please.
I'd like to think that's true anyway.
It's not, it's...
but
yes, we are that dumb.
It's crazy. It's almost like someone's taken a bet, you know, $1. It feels like it's like this trading places thing where it's like, let's just see how far we can push this,
right?
You know, which then if that is the case, it's still terrifying,
right?
Because it's stirring the silt from the bottom of the pond, and all the shit's rising up and going, yay.
And again, it's the media. You know, the media is definitely to blame as far as really highlighting some of those things, but I think it's really important for that stuff to be out there so people see it.
Yeah.
I mean, the reason you study, you know, the reason you go visit Auschwitz or Hiroshima is so that you don't forget that we're absolutely capable of those things. There's nothing different about us now than there was, however we were wired 3,000 years ago. There's nothing different about us. It's not like we've all of a sudden gotten better as human beings. We're still capable of those. We're still doing those atrocious things to each other right now.
Yeah.
Whatever you read about in the history books, we're still doing it. It's not like it was something that happened back then and now we're better people. So we're capable of all those things. So it's not out of the realm of possibilities that the people you're talking about and the things you're witnessing in the media, of course that's us. Of course that's everywhere.
Yeah.
They're just, you don't see it as often because you just don't, why would you nurture that?
Yeah.
And it's in all of us. It's not necessarily, you know, education definitely, and, you know, economics and education play a huge part, and of course the whole, you know, teaching a man to fish, handing him fish definitely doesn't help. But
on a purely biological level, the way that the human brain is built, you know, the very center of it, top of the brain stem, is the R complex, which is that's a lizard's brain. Like, you know, it's just pure aggression and stupid instinct, I guess. It's never gonna.
And I would, you know. So yeah, that's my tin hat version of this election is that, and you know, but my cynical side is that they're all in it together, and
it's like
I don't doubt that, you know, my conspiracy theorist side of me says that Trump is basically hired by Hillary Clinton to throw this election.
Yeah. Yeah, I think
the only fly in her ointment is Bernie Sanders, who is far more effective outside of that office than he would be in the office. I'm not sure how that's going to work.
Yeah. Yeah, he seems like definitely the best option. But not if he's in that office.
If he's in that office, his hands will be tied and he won't get anything done.
Yeah. Something I only found out about the other day about Hillary was that she was recently campaigning on the whole total disclosure thing, and I'd watched like a load of Dr. Stephen Greer like lectures and stuff, and see, I do have a tinfoil hat which I wear on a regular basis.
That's fine.
I'm a big fan of it, but I heard that was one of the things that she was campaigning on recently, and I think that there's enough people now that would be like, well, yeah, we need to know this stuff. Anyway.
Yeah, I don't know where. I have no idea where it's gonna go. I'm just hoping it doesn't go dark.
I mean, you're in a good place geographically, right?
I'm surrounded by Republicans, generally speaking.
Yeah.
But they're all mostly farmers. So we get along because, you know, the vineyards are something that really erases those social, economic, religious, political lines. We're all working together toward, you know, somewhat common goals.
Hmm.
So we don't talk politics.
Yeah, which is a beautiful thing. All right, cool. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to Maynard James Keenan, and thank you to you lot for listening as well. Please subscribe on iTunes, leave a nice comment. That makes a big difference. Remember that the Pussifer album, The Money Shot, is out now. You should check that out if you don't already own it, because it's fantastic. And you can follow the band online at Pussifer on Twitter and Instagram, etc. The podcast is on at Swim Podcast. I'm on at Daniel P. Carter. And the next episode is going to be with Billy Gould of Faith No More. And then the one.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
After that is Alan Moore. Thanks for listening. I'm out. Peace.